Hi, everyone. I wanted to start out today with a quick shout out to Matron Saint, a super chic maternity line that wants to revolutionize the way you dress as you embark on motherhood. Their clothes are simple, stylish, and comfortable. Use the code PYC20 when you check out for 20% off your order. Now I want to ask you, my listeners, for a shout out. Rate and review Yoga Birth Babies on iTunes or Stitcher, and follow PYC and Matron Saint on Instagram for your chance to win a $100 gift card from Matron Saint. Email a screenshot of your review and your handle to info@prenatalyogacenter.com. Thanks for listening. Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Welcome to Yoga, Birth, Babies, a podcast produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. We will be diving into everything prenatal yoga, birth, and baby related, hoping to inspire, educate, and empower you through your journey into motherhood. Thank you for listening. Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg, and I'm your host for Yoga Birth Babies. And today we're going to talk about informed consent and implied consent. And what does that mean? And what are your rights? So we have Kristen Piscucci here, and we're going to ask her to explain all that wonderful information. So let me tell you a little bit about Kristen. Kristen Piscucci is a former communication strategist at a top public affairs firm in Baltimore, Maryland. Kristen is the founder of Birth Monopoly and Birth Monopoly's Doula Power Group, co-creator of the Exposing the Silence Project, and from 2012 to 2016, vice president of national advocacy organization Improving Birth. She has run an emergency hotline for women facing threats to their legal rights in childbirth, created a viral consumer campaign to break the silence on trauma and abuse in childbirth, and helped out obstetrics violence in maternity care crisis in national media. Today, she's a leading voice for women giving birth, speaking around the country, and consulting privately for consumers and professionals on issues related to birth rights and options. Kristen is also the host of Birth Aloud Radio, as well as executive producer of a documentary filmed for release in 2019 to start a national conversation on obstetric violence, birth trauma, and women's rights in birth. Hi, Kristen. How are you?
Hi, Deb. I'm great. How are you?
Oh, good. So I'm glad that our systems are hooked up. We're ready to chat. For those that don't know, we had a little system malfunction, but that is kind of fun of podcasting. And with Kristen having her own podcast, you should see us. We're both geeked out with our headphones and our microphones. So we are ready to talk about informed consent and implied consent. But before we do that, so you guys have heard on Kristen's bio that she doesn't necessarily come from a birth background originally. She was working in PR. So Kristen, what inspired this change from working in PR and communications to starting Birth Monopoly?
Well, I was working at a public affairs firm, and public relations is a piece of that, that whole world, which also includes politics, like political consulting, media, business. And I got pregnant while I was in that career, which was a pretty high pressure, high stress way of life. And so I would like run from these meetings to my OB appointments. And it really struck me kind of the contrast between how I was treated in my job and how I was treated in my OB's office. So of course I'm, you know, in a field where communications is absolutely critical. And it was very different when I went to the doctor because I felt like communication wasn't happening. And, you know, I would ask really direct questions and I'd get really, really roundabout answers or really no answer at all on a lot of things. At some point, you know, I had walked in there asking for a scheduled C-section for my baby. And as I was doing all this research throughout my pregnancy, I decided, hold on, that might not be the route that I want to go. What I really wanted, I think, ultimately was a feeling of control, which I know is a very loaded idea, but we can maybe talk about that a little bit more. I wanted to not be, I wanted to not be traumatized. And when I was watching birth videos online in the course of my research, I saw a lot of things that felt traumatizing to me. The way women were being sort of told what to do and they were in pain, and the pain did not look productive. It just looked like torture. And then I came across videos of people having these really calm water births at home, and something kind of clicked in my head. And I realized when I'm thinking about control, I'm thinking I want it to be in a sterile field with me, you know, knocked out and not having to participate, and them sort of doing everything that needs to be done, sewing me up and handing me a baby. That felt like a sense of control to me. And then I realized that actually birth could be something that the mother is in charge of, although I don't think we ever have control over birth, certainly. But you can have control over the circumstances, and you can have some control over how you are treated and whether you're supported in your choices. And so I, you know, just kind of happened on this and realized that these births looked wonderful and peaceful and non-traumatic. And eventually I decided that I was going to try for a birth with no medication, and one where I just sort of did all the work and actively gave birth to my baby. So I switched to nurse midwives, sort of by accident at one point. And then after 41 weeks, I was getting a lot of pressure to induce. And I was told that I had to come in, like on one day, I was told, you have to come in tonight. And that day I ended up firing that midwife and going to a different nurse midwife at a different hospital, who gave me all the options and all the choices and all the control and the freedom. So my birth ended up being very different from what I had originally planned with a scheduled C-section. And then I think what I would have gotten with the nurse midwifery practice that I switched away from, where I was sort of being told, you know, you really don't have a choice about, you know, being induced. I started researching my rights a lot after that. I was really curious about what leverage I had had in that situation, if I had not been so lucky as to find another midwife who kind of handed me back that authority. And I came across all these stories of these women who, like, didn't dodge the bullet that I dodged and had negative birth experiences, trauma, a lot of complications that I think, you know, many of them felt were preventable or avoidable. And I just never went back to my career from that point, because I just found this so fascinating. And, you know, one aspect of it was that I had always seen birth as so gross and disgusting and in like demeaning, really. And, I, you know, just kind of came to this whole new perspective on childbirth, and in that on women and femininity and feminism. And so that was really interesting. Like, in a weird way, I actually became a feminist because of childbirth, which was something that I would never have identified with before. So, and it was part of that journey of, you know, looking into my rights and looking at how other women's rights were being treated in childbirth, and realizing that, oh my goodness, we need feminism in childbirth, because women are really being treated as if they lose their basic civil rights. They lose ownership over their bodies when they are pregnant or giving birth.
You just said so much. I'm like, where do I go with this? Because
sorry,
no, it's so amazing.
I said, it's gonna be a short interview. I'll make it really short. Don't worry.
What I love about that is, like, so I do a teacher training, and part of it is a lot of these people come into the training with kind of the idea that you have, and I don't think it's different than the majority of people. It's painful. It's gross. I don't want to be involved. Just get me the baby. And then as they dive deeper into birth, we read so many books. It's like a college course. It's massive.
Yeah.
One of the questions at the end, they read a ton of essays. So the first essay is when we meet is, what's your perception of birth? And then at the end, I say, has your perception changed? And across the board, everyone's perceptions changed. It can be peaceful. It can be beautiful. It can be painful, but in a productive way. You know, I can take autonomy over my body. And I think if we peel back that curtain of, you know, what we are painted, social media, just friends movies. And relatives, movies, TV, if we pull that back and dive a little deeper, it really can change, which changes the whole landscape of birth. So you absolutely hit it on the head.
Yeah. And for me, I didn't know until I did a ton of processing why it was that I feared birth so much and thought it was so demeaning and humiliating. I mean, like, I think if you had asked me one adjective to describe birth prior to, you know, that time, I would have said humiliating.
Well, it can be. And unfortunately, yeah. it can be shameful and humiliating when it shouldn't. And
right.
And I think that's
where I thought that without anyone ever using that word, right? Mm-hmm. That was just like what I was picking up, like, unconsciously from media, from friends, from family members, you know?
Yeah. So I think that is a perfect segue into understanding one's rights. And let's go into that. So
sure.
We hear a lot about informed consent. It's kind of a hot word right now, implied consent. Can you break that down, what the difference is and what it means in maternity care?
Yeah. So informed consent, as it relates to healthcare, is the idea. It's based on the human right that each person owns their own body, and that is a right that also applies to your medical care. So, you have the right to make choices about the medical care that you receive. Ultimately, and including, and possibly most important, the right to say no. And that is a really strongly held right, not only in maternity care, and actually I might even say except for maternity care, that you can't be given surgery against your will, that you can't be compelled to, for example, have surgery to benefit someone else who might, you know, it might be a very minor surgery for you and it might be a life-saving benefit for them, but we have upheld time after time after time for a very long time that that ultimate right to say no, that it's a critical right, and that to violate that right is an assault on the person. So informed consent, practically speaking, is usually described as it's a conversation and it's a process that in which information is conveyed to, you know, from care provider to patient about the risks and the benefits and the alternatives of whatever they're suggesting. So if, for example, you know, a physician is saying, let's put induction on the table, what they are legally and ethically obligated to do about that idea of an induction is to share, here are the risks of an induction. Here are the benefits to you potentially. And here's why I am suggesting this. And here are some alternatives to that. Here's what might happen if we do nothing, or maybe we try a different type of induction, or maybe we just wait a day or whatever it is. And then the patient gets to make a free choice among the alternatives. So it's a right that I think we're really clear about in other areas that are not maternity care. Informed consent is a term that, you know, like you said, you know, it's sort of a hot term right now. It's something that anyone, any medical professional, nurse, doctor, whatever, has heard, has learned about, you know, it's a concept that's taught, but it's just not treated as a reality in a lot of maternity care. And go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to think, like, so when you were told that you need to be induced, were you given the risk versus the benefits? Because I know that my clients and my students,
right,
they don't get that conversation. And they get what,
right,
you had mentioned,
right,
like, I have to come in. Well, what happens if I don't come in? You know?
Yeah, so, what do you mean I have to? Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I, you know, to the best of my recollection, it was, it's for the baby. Okay, what does that mean? What does that mean? It's for the baby. Like, that is not medical information. And it's what we like to do. I mean, that is not, those are not answers to the question, what are the risks or benefits or alternatives? Mm-hmm. And my memory is really fuzzy. I certainly was not, recording anything. But my impression to this day is, gosh, I wasn't given any real information. There was no, if you don't induce, we are worried that this will happen. The odds of that happening are around this. You know, that would have been meaningful information that I could have made an informed decision on, but I couldn't get those answers. And, funny because another aspect of it is that later I looked back and thought, my goodness, what if an induction would have been better, like a better bet? I said no, because I couldn't get information, like to the point of if I had needed that induction, I wasn't trusting the recommendation because of the refusal to give me anything more than sort of platitudes about, we just want you to have the induction. It's for your baby's safety. Just really vague information, which from my training, in my, prior life, it's sort of a golden rule in a negotiation. If anyone's pressuring you, they want an answer before you're ready to give an answer, ultimately, then you say no.
So
you never get pressured into a yes.
Yeah, so if the information's given without pressure or demeaning or belittling you that we know better, then women might actually say, I'm hearing the risk versus benefits. I actually hear the benefits of why I might need to be induced, and I accept that. But if something's kind of being right. shoved in your face, then most of us kind of, get our feathers ruffled and kind of put up a wall. And it's interesting because ACOG even states that the physician has to give the risk versus benefits and, alternatives of the risk versus benefits.
Right.
And I've never seen that.
Yeah. I mean, these are, and that's what's so kind of shocking about the whole situation is ACOG is very clear about it. The law is clear about it. Informed consent and refusal. We should always include and refusal on that. These are really basic ideas that are legal and ethical obligations. They're not suggestions. They're not guidelines. They're not, they're nothing short of obligations and requirements. I mean, ACOG uses the term requirement. Mm-hmm. So that is what's kind of shocking to me. And, when you were just describing a second ago about, kind of having something shoved down your throat and your kind of instinctive reaction is to say no. Well, it was like, I felt like I wasn't being treated like an adult. I mean, that was really it. It was, like you have a plumber come in to your house and you say, I want a pedestal sink. And they say, no, we're going to do the kind with the cabinet. And you're like, I'm sorry, what? But I wanted the pedestal. And they're like, nope. Well, why? Why is that? Well, this kind is better. But what do you mean by that? Do you know what I mean? If you say, because we're going to have to tear out your whole wall to put this pedestal sink in, and your house is too old to support a pedestal sink, and it would be better for that reason, I'd go, oh, of course, let's go with the one you're suggesting. But when you're, kind of not communicating with the other person as an intelligent adult who deserves information and deserves just an honest conversation.
And it's about your body and your baby. It's not about us, the sink. Actually, I can see people oh yeah, I get that. I would do that. And then others are like, well, my doctor told me I should do this. And so I think what we're trying to get here is that just because your care provider says you should do something, it's the woman's right to ask why. So,
right. And why would you doubt your care provider is maybe a big question for some people. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I also, this was a real eye opener for me. Was I always had the idea that pretty much all doctors are the same. Their bedside manner might vary. I might like one personality a little bit more than another, but it didn't matter who I went to. My birth would happen the same no matter where I went, right?
Oh,
like
so,
that was my,
yeah.
Right? And I think she thinks that.
Yeah.
Well, That could not be further from the truth.
Yeah, the care provider paints the picture for the relationship and how the birth's going to unfold.
Your care provider decides how your birth is going to go. And that is all there is to it. And, you know, now, you know, 5 years later, after talking to hundreds of women and nurses and midwives and doulas and doctors, you know, like this is, I can say this with a lot of confidence. Your provider determines how your birth is going to go. And that includes your provider, allowing you to determine how the birth is going to go, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm including that in the bucket. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, and maybe this is getting onto a different topic, but why it's so important that you carefully choose your provider.
Oh, absolutely.
You might get 20 different doctors who will treat your birth 20 different ways. And it's really important that people know that. And it has very little to do with medical necessity. It is all about what that provider's practice style is, comfort level, I think more than anything, just what they're used to doing.
Mm-hmm. So if a woman does have a sense that she wants to know the big picture and have some voice in it, I guess the prenatal part of, you know, the pregnancy and the meetings prenatally will really help her realize if she's aligned. So do you suggest then that they have these conversations about risk versus the benefits during the meetings, their prenatal meetings?
I do. I think it's, yeah, I mean, this is definitely not something that you practice for and show up in birth and, you know, hope I'm going to be able to communicate properly. You know, we're going to make this happen in the moment. But I would even say it can be really tricky for a pregnant person to, you know, in a pretty brief prenatal appointment over the course of weeks or months to suss out without knowing a ton about birth and maternity care to suss that out. I usually tell people, go straight to the source, and the source is birth workers, doulas, birth educators. They are the people who see the providers in action time after time after time and can say with some certainty, you know, this is how this person practices. To me, that just kind of skips the whole problem of trying to figure out, you know, how forthcoming is this person? You know, are they going to change when we get in the room? Because, you know,
well, not I've to heard be- of that happening too.
Yeah. And, I hate to sound, you know, so negative. I mean, I really do. And, you know, I want to say I'm actually not being negative. I'm just being honest that sometimes, you know, people get kind of a bait and switch where, mm-hmm. you know, they might have a very, you know, kind and respectful provider during prenatal care. And then it comes to delivery and they get something very different. And that's, you know, that's a kind of a scary scenario.
Well, let's talk about that. And that kind of brings me into implied consent, because that's when care providers may feel they have the right to do X, Y, and Z because they're the woman's in the birth center or hospital. So can you talk about what the difference is between informed and then implied consent? So what's implied consent? Okay.
So implied consent is where you don't explicitly say, yes, I consent to this thing, but consent is just assumed because of some action you've taken prior to that or words you have said prior to that. So an example might be, some people will say you have implied consent to whatever treatment you get during maternity care because you agreed to be admitted to the hospital and you signed consent forms when you came in. And so in some people's minds, that means you no longer have, like, there's no additional consent after that point. You have given consent for everything, and that's all there is to it. That is a really skewed and flawed and inaccurate idea of what implied consent is. But to take it out of maternity care, you break your arm and you go to an emergency room you're implying consent there, right? That you have shown up there with an injury and you are seeking treatment at a place that offers, you know, can fix a broken arm. That is implying some consent, right? But the difference is if they say, hey, we're going to do this to fix your arm, and you say, actually, no, I don't want that done, they have to stop. You don't get to overrule that person's refusal just because they said no or because they said yes earlier. Another area in life, sadly, is in sex, where we see implied consent really misapplied. You'll hear like, she implied consent to having sex with that person because she went to his hotel room. So the idea is he didn't have to get consent for anything that happened in the hotel room because she's already implied consent by going to the hotel room. So, it's implied consent is something that has been used as sort of a hammer, I think, on women in a lot of ways. And we need to really set the record straight as far as this idea that once you go to the hospital or once you sign those consent forms, that's it.
So what are the consent forms? When someone shows up at a hospital, and I've seen clients, I actually did not birth in a hospital, so I've never signed those myself, but I've seen my clients, they sign these forms. What rights do they have in labor and birth once they've signed and they've been admitted to the birth center or hospital? They still can say no. Correct?
Yeah, well, this is the exciting thing. They have all the same rights. In fact, there has been some talk with some lawyers I work with over whether those admission forms are even constitutionally viable. Or that's not the right term, but whether they're really legal. How do I put this? It's not legally appropriate to ask someone to sign a form that
like
would
a blanket consent
invalidate, like, right? Would invalidate their constitutional rights later? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So you walked in, signed this, we have the right now to do whatever.
Right. And sometimes those forms will say things like, you know, you agree to allow us to do to administer medically necessary treatment. Sometimes they say any treatment we deem appropriate. Sometimes, they vary, but the whole idea is by signing this paper, you have now turned over your rights to us, basically. And that is inaccurate. It's wrong. It's illegal. And I think in a lot of ways it's very sexist.
And it's traumatizing. You give away your voice, you give away your body and the right to choose what happens to it. Yeah. And I've seen that. I've seen that as a doula, and it's so disturbing. I remember one birth I did. The mom had, she was an older mom. She had her first baby in Germany, and and they didn't have the exact records of what the scar was, and it was a cesarean. And her doctor's like, yeah, you can VBAC, you can VBAC, you can VBAC. And then she starts labor. And it's the first time I really saw this kind
bait
of
bait and switch.
Bait and switch. But it wasn't even just like, oh no, you can't have it. But there was an aggressiveness that when she said, wait a minute, we talked about this. No, I'd like to try at least a trial of labor. And they came, you know, as many people came in to talk to her, and the kind of like, hey, we're gonna try this, came into very aggressive conversation. And she basically had to sign a waiver of, I think, a refusal to accept the medical advice of her care provider. And she did. And she labored and labored and labored, and she did not actually progress. And because they didn't know.
Oh, it'd be so hard to progress in that environment.
I know. How do you progress when they're like looking at you like, see, we told you this wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And she, after probably about 12 hours, said, okay, I'm ready to have a cesarean. And she had mixed feelings at our postnatal. We talked about it, and she said, I felt good that I made the call when to have a cesarean, but I felt that the staff was against me and I was labeled the difficult person. Yeah. And she was she was right. You know, we weren't getting the soft cuddling. I'd been to that hospital many times. We weren't getting that same reception that we had gotten even just walking in the door.
Respectful.
Yeah, it was not respectful at all. So
yeah.
How does, yeah. What do we do? How do we advocate for women not to have that situation?
Well, I'll tell you, it's very difficult as an individual. I mean, I'm sure you have discovered that yourself. There are definitely things that women can do to set themselves up for the best case scenario. And I think I work with a lot of doulas, and I think we have to be really careful about what we understand the doula's role to be and the responsibilities and just the capabilities. Having a doula does not guarantee that your rights are going to be respected, that you are going to be respected. It's not possible, you know, and it's not fair to expect that from doulas, when you have a whole system set up one way and then you think that you can go in and somehow get exceptional treatment. I do think that, as you know, I mentioned before about the provider being so critical. I do think that's true. I think that the provider, sets the tone. The provider, unfortunately, does kind of set the parameters for how much you will be allowed to do anything. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking more of in a hospital-based setting when I say that. We do know that, you know, like the situation that you mentioned, there's the case of Renat Dre in the state of New York, who was a woman who had planned a VBAC with the support of her doctor. And then she went in for her VBAC and her doctor wasn't there. And she got an on-call doctor who just said, well, I don't do VBAC. And they forced her to have a C-section. And, you know, it came out in the trial and afterwards that the hospital actually had a written policy about this, that they did believe that they had the right to force a woman to have surgery if they decided that they, you know, they wanted to do that. And they argued in court that the hospital has the right to decide, you know, whether the woman has the C-section. Sorry, I'm getting off on a
totally. This is great.
I guess my point is, if you go to a hospital that has a written policy that ultimately they get to violate your body, that's what, I mean, you're making the choice to walk into that environment. And I absolutely don't want to be judgy or victim blamey about this, because I understand this is how the system is largely set up.
And there may not be other choices. Certainly. I know in New York we've got, yeah, so many, yeah, hospitals, although they're kind of getting eaten up by a couple main hospitals buying others. But in certain places, they don't have more than one hospital or even a choice of doctors.
Right. And this is why, when I go back to saying it's very hard for an individual sometimes to, you know, counter all of this, advocacy and activism is so important, because that we need to change that policy. You know, that policy shouldn't be a thing. The hospital's lawyers should not at any point have thought it was okay to put a policy like that in writing.
So does that policy override a woman's right of refusal?
Absolutely not. But in their minds, it does, you know? And once it's done, it's done. You can't go back and unsurgery someone.
Of course.
You know?
So can someone in that situation actually say no, even though, like, we're forcing you, you have to? What can, especially if someone's in labor, like, what do you do to say, I'm leaving?
What I tell people now is, you know, you use the words, I do not consent. A partner hopefully would have the wherewithal and the, you know, just presence of mind, which many people don't. I don't know that I would, you know, if I weren't trained in this. I hear her saying no. I hear her saying she's not going to consent. Will you document that she is saying no, and you are choosing, you are telling her you are going to do this anyway?
That's great language. That's really good language. It's very clear.
Yeah, to document it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then also, I just lost my thought.
Sorry.
I going to say? Record it. absolutely 100% record it. I would say I'm turning on my phone now. I'm turning on my camera. I'm recording what you're doing. Now, granted, this is, you know, what we're talking about here is certainly the worst case scenario. You know, I mean, this is when you have no other options, because, you know, the reality is, it's not going to make them feel warm and fuzzy towards you if you're saying I'm recording what you're doing right now. But I, you know, I guess when you're at that point of, you know, hostility, you know, these are at least some tools that you have if you have to, you know, maybe go there. But, you know, my hope is that people don't ever get to that point, that we can make the best decision possible about providers. You know, if it's possible to have a doula, I think that is so critical. If, you know, if you're able to make that happen, to have a doula who understands what the environment is like at the facility or with the provider where you're going, and that you've had a really open, honest conversation about what it might look like in the room. So it might be, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, a situation in another state where it's a doula who works with a doctor who she says is so wonderful, except he always cuts an episiotomy. It's like he has it in his head that he has to cut an episiotomy. Now, he's wonderful with everything else, right? And he's, you know, in that case, I think it would be totally appropriate and great, and this doula does do this, to say to her clients, okay, you know, this is the doctor you've chosen. I am going to give you a little bit of information about how he practices based on what I have seen with my own two eyes. He likes to do episiotomies. He may not ask before he does an episiotomy. And if this is something that you either don't want or you want to be given a choice about having, you want to, you know, you want him to ask permission before he does this, here's what we can do when that happens. So, partner, I need you to watch. I need you to have your eyes on, you know, see what's going on. Here's, you know, what we're going to say. Here's the exact language we are going to say. If I see him picking up a pair of scissors, this is what I'm going to say. Partner, you know to listen to this. Listen for this, right? Mom, you know this is coming. And to, you know, play it out ahead of time. I feel like it takes away a lot of the fear and the uncertainty, and that those unknown factors. And honestly, you might, and this is how, you know, I've seen this happen before where, you know, the parents have gone, my goodness, we're doing all this practicing. I mean, what if we just chose a doctor who doesn't always do an episiotomy? What does that look like? And then the doula might be able to say, as a matter of fact, you know, there's a midwifery practice in that hospital, and they're wonderful, and you know, this is my experience with them. But I think that practice and that preparation ahead of time is a really great thing.
Yeah, the role playing. And do you have any suggestions for specific language? I know, like, there's the nonviolent language that someone can feel they're not, because I've seen when people come in, especially some moms, are like, "This is my birth plan," and I've seen eye rolls, and, you know, where it really thinks they're trying to protect their space, they sometimes get eye rolls. So do you have any suggestion of how someone can come across still holding their ground, you know, still defending their rights and their partner and hopefully their doula, but not, again, be labeled as like, oh, there is that birth plan coming in again. You know what I mean?
That high maintenance woman with her unreasonable expectations. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think we've up to this point have talked about a lot of kind of downer topics and worst case scenarios and, you know, some really negative stuff. And ironically, I think the antidote to that is really love, compassion, and positivity, which is kind of funny, right? You know, I think one of the most important things that a doula can do is to humanize everyone in the room. To take that, you know, when people are doing their jobs, and they get in a routine and they get in a, you know, it's almost like an autopilot, right? To kind of run an intervention on that and remind everyone that these were all human beings, and we're all in maybe an emotionally charged situation. My this is my client's first baby. And I have to tell you, I think she's really nervous. She could really use some help from you. I think just a few kind words would make a really big difference to her. And, you know, as the nurse, it would really mean a lot coming from you. You know, almost empowering the caregivers to treat your client like a human being, and modeling that, you know, I think asking permission of the client before you touch them, for example, which might not be something you would do outside of the hospital, but it might be a tool for modeling that in the hospital that, you know, it helps set the tone a little bit when the nurse hears you say, you know, can I touch your back right now? Is that okay with you? Is it okay if I, you know, whatever? You know, these are things that you can sort of, you know, again, help set the tone. But I, you know, I just kind of go back to that humanization and the bringing that love in the room. I mean, coming in fearful, defensive really contributes to the feeling of fear and defensiveness in the room.
And they're not going to want to make that extra effort to really listen if they're already like, oh, it's that person. And I think, yeah. I love what you said, kind of, you know, really gently, she's nervous, thank you for your help, because it does break, you know, I've seen the nurses, I think they really do mean well, but you know, you can get on autopilot, it can be exhausted. They could have just pulled it at the end of their 12-hour shift. And when you break that up, here's just another person in room four, you know, she's nervous, and you approach them, I think it breaks that bubble of like, oh yeah, here's a person in front of me, as opposed to, I got to chart this person. Like, you know, I got to chart room four. You're like, oh, she's a person birthing. I tell my, my clients and my students, and I know maybe this is a little bribery, but I'm like, when you're in the early stage of labor, have a birth project, like make cookies for the staff, you know, like they like that. Like if you're the person showing up with a plate of brownies, they're going to remember room four brought brownies and maybe be like, this is great. And, you know, have a little softer. So,
No, I think that's a good example of a way to kind of break up that
monotony,
that autopilot. Right. And look, we have to be realistic too about probably more so for doulas, but we have to remember who we are working with. These are people who are likely traumatized themselves. You know, there's a very high rate of PTSD, job-related PTSD among nurses and among doctors. Doctors have a really high suicide rate. They are in a system that has traumatized them in their training, and then they're in a job that can be very traumatic and they don't have a lot of support in either. I have found, Deb, that it is really helpful for me personally to find compassion for someone when I can see, when I can remember about them. This is a person who's been hurt. This is a person who has been traumatized. She's carrying around all this baggage because she's witnessed horrible things. You know, maybe, you know, they might have had a baby not make it last week, and she's still dealing with the implications of having to be in that room and, you know, not having anywhere to process that. And so she's carrying around all of this baggage. To me, that really helps in my mind to humanize.
Yeah, you're right.
The people that you're working with, you know,
because it's easy to demonize the doctors. You're like, oh, they're not listening. They're not doing this. You're absolutely right.
It is. I mean, and my goodness, I, you know, especially like what I do, I deal with people every day who have been violated and hurt and traumatized by, you know, this group of people, you know, and it is really easy to demonize that group. But I think that is very counterproductive. It doesn't do anything except kind of pit us against each other more. So I think we can be really honest and realistic about what is happening. And also it only helps to be compassionate about where they are coming from and why they're doing the things that they're doing. It certainly, it, you know, like I said before, you know, the last thing you want to do is come in and add to the tension. And I do think that sort of responsibility falls more on, the support people. I don't think it's fair at all to ask a laboring mom, you know, make sure you're really loving while you're in there, try to have your baby, you know, I mean, I think that's a little ridiculous, but, But yeah, and certainly for doulas, I think, being very mindful and very conscientious about their own, the attitude that they're bringing in and the preconceptions and the biases and the baggage and the trauma really, can be really helpful to your own sanity and your own mental health and emotional health.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any suggestions that if say they don't have a doula there, but a partner starting to see something they didn't quite, I keep going back to this one birth I saw, it was an episiotomy. They didn't ask, and the woman is actually not medicated, and there was an assumption she was. I was up by the head of, the mom, and the partner said later he saw them going for the scissors, but didn't know what was going on.
Right.
Is there a way to empower the partner? Because he was in his own state of, it was starting to get a little chaos. So how can we protect the woman? And I guess this goes back, I'm answering my own question. This goes back to the conversation prenatally, but sometimes student doctors come in or residents and they're getting involved. I just always want to help the woman not feel violated, because mm-hmm. so many women already are coming into birth with a background of harm or trauma or violation.
Yes, totally.
And then we don't want birth to be that space again. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. Boy, that's a big, question.
Off the top of your head.
Yeah. Let me problem solve this right now. Well, I'm actually really glad that you brought up previous trauma, because I think that is really huge, something that isn't paid enough attention to. And as long as it is okay with the client's consent, I think it's a great, great, great idea to communicate to the care providers that this is someone who has a previous trauma history. I think, Deb, that is one way to click them out of autopilot, because the medical education that I see and the stuff that I see going around now in journals and, in nurses' pages and stuff like that is there is this recognition that a person with an abuse or trauma, sexual trauma, especially history, needs a different level of care. And that is a different level of care that that they have at least an idea about, right? Now, between me and you and, our listeners, I think everyone should always get that level of care, because we don't want to send people out of delivery traumatized. But let's, roll it back to where we actually are. I do think that with the client's consent, sharing that with the staff is on the par, and kind of like earlier when I said, we could really use your help. Could you help us? She's really nervous. It's her first baby, that kind of thing. That it's kind of that same idea of that person-to-person contact where you're saying, I'm going to be a little vulnerable right here and share with you something that is, I'm trusting you by telling you this. And I'm hoping that you can reciprocate that trust by treating this person in the way that, I'm basically asking you to treat them like a human, treat them respectfully. Anyway, super long-winded way of saying, I think it's great if it's okay with the client to identify that trauma history to staff, because yes, in a lot of ways, or a lot of times that will click something in them like, oh, okay, I do need to ask permission before I touch her. I do need to give her extra explanation.
But they should be asking permission all the time before they touch her.
Yes.
It shouldn't just have to be flagged 100%. As this person, had a background.
I have a lot of mixed feelings when I see like the bulletins and opinions and statements and articles about this, because every time I want to go, but everyone deserves that. Like these people most of all, but everyone deserves that. Because guess what? A woman with no trauma history can walk out with sexual trauma because of how she's treated in birth.
And I have seen that. I read about it. I've had clients come back saying they actually feel abused or traumatized, maybe not even physically, but emotionally unheard, and circling back to what you said, humiliated or shamed or yelled at. They told me I wasn't doing it right. They told me I wasn't pushing right. And when a woman's pushing in labor, as you've been there, in a hospital setting, especially, there's a big light on your vagina. There's people in the room. You know, it's a really vulnerable.
People telling you what to do.
It's a vulnerable place to be. And then to say, you're not doing it right. And all that mom is wanting to do is get this baby out and meet her baby. You know, I've seen the other side, and that that's what breaks my heart. And that's, I guess, what sparked me to want to have this conversation of informed consent, implied consent, but I guess really comes to human right and dignity being upheld during birth. Because then the mom can be traumatized, and then she has to start this difficult road of motherhood feeling beaten up.
Yeah, and you know, it's such a big concept. You know, people are always saying to me, so what are my legal rights? And I'm like, I mean, that sounds like a very straightforward, concrete question and answer. But the reality is we already have all these legal rights. The thing is, they're just not being respected. And at some point, you kind of have to get to this moment about yourself that I'm not going to just take the rights and treatment that they decide I deserve. I decide how I want to be treated, and I have to assert that, or I have to make that happen. You know, I think, you know, so many of us, I certainly, you know, grew up in a very, you know, in a way of like, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, and you always respect authority.
People
and
pleaser.
You always respect your elders, and it was like really... not shocking, but it was kind of a paradigm shift for me to go, wow, I really have to ultimately act as if and believe that I am my own authority, that I am the
worthy
authority
of that authority.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm that's a big one.
Even when people are telling me, you're not the authority. I have to be very strong in knowing that I actually am the authority. And when I say that, I'm, you know, I don't mean that in a way of like, I'm the authority. I don't need any help and I don't need any advice and I don't need any support. That's not at all what I mean. In fact, I think when you're giving birth, you need all the help and all the support and you deserve all of that, but it should always be on your terms, you know? You know, it's not unlikely that you will need help. You know, I mean, things happen, complications happen. Sometimes your body needs a little help with something. Sometimes emotionally you need a little bit of help with something. But there's a big difference between supporting someone and managing them.
Yes, absolutely. And kind of goes back to what I was saying with that VBAC, where she finally could say, yes, I'm ready to have that. I'm ready to have the cesarean, but she did it on her terms. I think that's a huge thing. If we lay out the rights and the rights that the woman has to make a decision, she understands the risk versus the benefits, and then she makes the decision, even if it's not the birth that she had envisioned, because rarely is it the birth that we all envision. You know, if she feels she had a voice in it, then I feel confident she's going to feel better after.
Absolutely. I think... you know, a sense of control is something that is that's absolutely a piece of trauma and PTSD related to childbirth. I mean, that's very much research based. We know that losing your sense of control is a factor in experiencing trauma. So I've actually been concentrating a lot more on that treatment aspect than the medical complications. Because I think a lot of us who work in birth have that idea that the fewer medical interventions you have, the less traumatic it's going to be. Right, exactly. But I think, you know, sometimes we have this ideal of as long as she has a natural birth, you know, where she's just not really interfered with, that, you know, trauma automatically is... you know, they're associated with each other or lack of trauma. And I just think, you know, I think it's a little bit of it's been conflated just a little bit. I think the reality is a lot of times there's less trauma when the woman is interfered with because she's more in control of the situation. And that's why she's not having interventions. But it's not because of the intervention that she had the trauma. I don't think I'm explaining this.
No, I totally get it. Like, a woman could, I totally get it. So a woman could easily have, you know, go in 6 centimeters, say, I'm ready for my epidural. She gets her epidural. She rests. She pushes her baby out. And even though she had intervention, she felt she had a say in it when it happened, and she had her baby. So yeah. I think, yeah, you know, intervention right. doesn't necessarily mean, I think it's when intervention's introduced without consent or understanding.
Without that sense of control, right? Yeah. 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 And that's, you know, and that's when we get into the type of trauma that I think everybody recognizes, which is when there's a, you know, an emergency or a medical complication. And then people are like, oh, okay, it's okay to say that was a traumatic birth because, wow, you know, the baby really was at risk, you know, wow, they really did save your baby's life in that situation. And then, you know, the general public is okay with saying, oh, that was a traumatic birth. But really, most of the trauma, if we're looking at it as a whole, it's not from medical complications. It's from the woman losing that sense of agency and control and autonomy and dignity.
Have you seen any improvements in maternity care? Because I feel like this is starting to get mainstreamed, like birth activism from
yeah.
your time.
Well, so yes, is Good. The answer to your question. and I'm really proud of how that's happened. And, you know, when I joined Improving Birth and, you know, originally I joined because they needed help with their rallies. Improving Birth does annual rallies around the country for, just for better maternity care. And they didn't have a press release or, you know, whatever it was. Long story short, we essentially turned those rallies into like media outreach, where in hundreds of cities or towns all over the country, the local media was getting press releases, contacts, you know, showing up and reporting on these rallies, talking to women who had talking points and knew what to say to those reporters and were prepared for that. I feel like that was... it absolutely has sparked a little bit of the, you know, where we are today with the media, that there's been a really it's been a strategy really to get the media to talk about these things. And okay, who cares about media, right? Well, media reflects culture and media influences culture. And when, you know, there are 25 news stories about Caroline Malatesta in Birmingham, Alabama, well, you better believe those hospitals are having meetings about what they're going to do now. Absolutely they are. And those marketing companies who created the false advertising that got those hospitals in trouble, they're going, oh my goodness, we need to really look at this. And we're also seeing, you know, we're seeing the bigger, the national organizations are now actually talking about things like disrespect and abuse and obstetric violence. And the reason for that is because women have been speaking out. And, you know, I was just talking to my friend Hermine Hayes Klein yesterday, who's the founder of Human Rights and Childbirth. And she made the statement, which I thought was a great one. She said, the term obstetric violence did not start with the people at the top. Obstetric violence is a term that came from activists and has been pushed upwards, you know? And we're absolutely seeing that. And I think it's a great thing. I can say from, you know, personal experience that 5 years ago, I couldn't get a reporter to touch a birth trauma or obstetric violence story. And today I have, you know, 20 people I could call and say, hey, I've got a good one for you. Listen to this. And they'd go, okay, like we're going to run this thing. So to me, that's a huge, like we got a huge wedge in the door and it's only getting bigger and bigger. So that's, you know, I know, you know, a lot of us get really discouraged and we're like, oh, what are things going to change? I feel like they are. They already have changed significantly, and it might not be so noticeable to people who aren't like following it like insane people, But I see the tipping point coming, and that's really exciting.
And I think it ties back to what we said at the very beginning when we started talking, just the shift of paradigm. You know, if things are starting to come into the media, into conversation, obstetric violence is a term a lot of people hadn't heard, but if now it's getting more conversational, it's going to change the idea of birth is this hysterical thing and women just need help. You know, like it's starting to give a little more power to the mom, which it should, and a little more ownership as well as responsibility that, you know, we can't have obstetric violence. It's not right for the mom and it's causing harm.
Look at the Harvey Weinstein stuff that's happening.
Yes.
Right? So it has taken decades to get to the point to where the media even cares that some big, powerful, rich white man has been accused of anything related to sexual harassment or sexual assault. And now suddenly we're seeing that not only is the media reporting on it, but women's voices are being heard. Women are using their voices, right, in a way that my mother, my grandmother would never, ever have told anyone that they were sexually harassed or assaulted. I mean, you didn't talk about those things, and it would be almost like a faux pas to go and say, you know, my boss, you know, whatever, whatever he might have done to me. And now the paradigm is shifting to where women are saying, I have a right to be heard. It's safe to be heard. You know, we're in a climate now where there's a measure of safety about talking about these things. So that's a really big deal to me. Deb, did you know that I'm making a documentary about it?
I did, because I read your bio.
Oh, okay. That's so funny. I just changed my bio. Like, yeah. I just changed it.
As I was reading, I'm like, oh, there's a documentary film planned for 2019. Yes, I do know that.
Yeah. Well, to me, that's like, I feel like that's been 5 years of work of getting us to the point where people will even hear about this topic. And now actually making the film to kind of pull back the curtain on how pervasive and ingrained violence against women is in childbirth. And
I can't wait
and
to
the
see
downstream
it.
Results of that.
I'm really excited to see it.
Yeah, you know, I thought I knew a lot about it. Ha ha ha. But even in doing more research now and talking to more experts who are outside the field of childbirth has been really, really fascinating, because I'm seeing so clearly, in a way I never saw before, the connecting the dots really on what happens to women in childbirth or in maternity care, I should say, and PTSD and postpartum depression. Like, there are just some really strong links or, you know, cause and effect that's happening that I think is just really, really fascinating and going to be really kind
it's
of
gonna be powerful
when people make this connection.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm so happy that that's going to come out. I think it will definitely be a good conversation starter. I also feel like you've now given people the voice to just question, to say, wait a minute, do I need to be induced, or, you know, learning that they have a right to refuse? Where can people find you? Because I think your work is fascinating.
Oh, thanks for asking and saying that. I'm at birthmonopoly.com, and right now that's the best place to go.
And you have a podcast?
Starting. I do. Yeah. And I was thinking, oh gosh, my to-do list, because I'm just working on setting up websites for the podcast and for the film. Yes, the podcast is Birth Aloud, Birth Aloud Radio. It's on iTunes and on SoundCloud. And I talk about a lot of these issues.
And you talk about some really interesting cases too. I was really fascinated by some of those and surprised I hadn't heard about them. So thank you for the work you've done. Is there anything last minute you want to share that you don't think we touched on?
Yeah, you know, there was just one other thing I wanted to say, and this isn't something I really talk about a lot, so I don't know how elegantly I'm going to state this, but people are constantly asking me, you know, what do we do? How do we protect ourselves? You know, how do we help our clients? You know, the more I've done, the more work I've done on all this, and the more I've delved into the system itself and the way the system operates, and the people who are in the system, you know, how they, why they behave the way that they do. I think that women really, really need to consider seriously going outside of that system. I myself did not have a home birth. I don't even know if I would have a home birth, but going outside of that system that is so ingrained that really needs to change in some very fundamental ways. And I feel like, you know, a lot of us are working really hard to change that system. But in the meantime, women are walking right back into that system, you know, hoping to like defend themselves with like, you know, bows and arrows when, you know, it's this giant, I don't know how to say that without sounding like really weird and hostile, but you know, I guess I would like to see women really thinking critically about why they're making the choices they're making. And if there are options that maybe don't feel comfortable because we don't grow up in everybody gives birth in a hospital in the United States. But I think going outside of that system is, the only way to actually guarantee that you're not walking into a potentially abusive or a traumatic situation. And of course, I completely acknowledge and respect that that is not for everyone. It can't be for everyone. You know, I mean, it wouldn't even be possible if people were willing. But I think for women who, you know, might be candidates for going outside of a hospital, to really, really consider that and get involved in your area in advocacy to make sure that those options are available.
That's perfect. It always comes back to where you birth and who you birth with. I've been doing this, you know, I've done like 80 podcasts, and I feel like that is the foundation. And mm-hmm. and thank you for mentioning that again, because, you know, the more we hear it, sometimes yeah. it means, sometimes you just need a different voice to say it, and then you're like, yeah, I get that.
Yeah. Well, I remember in that Alabama lawsuit where the mom won $16 million after, you know, an obstetric violence case, basically. I remember her lawyer in the opening called the care at that hospital. He called it a shoddy lottery. And I thought, whoa, that is a really good and harsh but true way yeah. to put it. You might walk in there and get the best care in the world, or you might walk in and be, physically forced and violated and traumatized.
And if so, for listeners, if you're like, what is she talking about? Go to Kristen's podcast and listen to that episode. My jaw dropped as I was listening to that. I'm like, really? They did what? They pushed the baby's head. What? Like, yeah, it was, and I've seen over 100 births, and I just have never seen that. So, which I'm glad.
I mean, I think it's a thing they do in Alabama. Honestly, they really do. I mean, it sounds like a crazy, you know, some like really rare scenario, but no, that actually is a thing that happens. There were dozens, if not more, women who contacted me and Caroline Malatesta to say that happened to me too.
Oh, that's upsetting. All right, we're going to wrap it up, but thank you for sharing so sure. much knowledge, and I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much.
Me too. You're such a good interviewer. I wish I could be as good of an interviewer, honestly. I'm not good at it.
Well, it's fun. I really like it. All right, well, enjoy your day, and again, thank you for the work you do. Take care. Too. Bye.
Bye.
For my yoga teacher friends who are interested in working with the pregnant population, Prenatal Yoga Center offers an 85-hour Yoga Alliance certified program based on our three-pronged theory of prenatal yoga: asana, education, and community. Once a year, we hold our three-month immersion program in New York City. For those who cannot attend this training, Caprice and I are now traveling to different locations holding our training at hosting studios where we will spend 6 days working together, exploring and learning about prenatal yoga. This training consists of more than 50 hours working together. We also created a whole membership website with more than 20 videos corresponding directly to the manual you will receive. For more information, check out our website at prenatalyogacenter.com. Hope to work with you soon. Take care.
This has been an episode of Yoga Birth Babies, produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. You can catch us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Thanks for listening.